Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. Today is an opportunity to just sit back and enjoy a powerful life change story. Today we'll hear from David Nasser, who is one of America's foremost evangelists, founder of David Nasser Outreach, and he's authored several books, including Glory Revealed and A Call to Die. But he tells his story in an amazing book called Jumping Through Fires, the gripping story of one man's escape from revolution to redemption. And we've shared this interview before, but I want to encourage you with it again as we listen to David Nasser's powerful testimony. David, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you so much for having me. What an honor. It's great to be with you today.
Your story goes back to the late 70s in Iran, and I'm going to ask you to kind of summarize it a little bit for us. But I thought maybe in terms of an opening statement is that, you know, it does seem like all across the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, and really much of, I suppose, the 1040 window, seems to be a lot of unrest. And you're not a stranger to revolution. It's been over 30 years ago. But take us through that maybe from the eyes of a child. You were, what, 9 years old when you snuck out of town, as it were?
Yeah, absolutely. I was nine when the Iranian Revolution happened in 1979, when the Ayatollah Khomeini and his religious zealots kind of overtook our government, when over about a million people were massacred and killed, when what I like to call religion gone wrong happened in our country. My dad was high ranked in the military, and so in 1979, when the revolution happened and the government was overthrown, my dad's life was in grave danger. And so we as a family were forced to escape, not just because of my dad's life, but our entire life. I remember those days, Neil. I remember soldiers coming to my school and putting a gun on my forehead and telling me they were going to kill me because of who my dad was, only to have the principal beg them to stop. And I remember people coming to our house and dragging my father out of our house and taking him to a park where they were going to torture him to death. And just, again, just by God's grace and mercy, was he spared that day. So we knew we had to get out. We knew we had a little bit of an open window, a limited amount of time to get out. And so we planned our escape and used my mom's heart issues that she'd had as an excuse to get some paperwork from some doctors. And we got two-way airline tickets like we were going and coming back. Well, we weren't coming back. We just ran for our lives. So, yeah, we are refugees. I mean, literally, we ran for refuge, you know. And we came to the United States under this thing called political asylum, which is just a fancy way of saying, you know, if we go back, we're dead. But, yeah, that's the beginnings of what I know as a revolution.
Wow.
Growing up. And when you're 9 years old, Neil, and you see a revolution go down like that, and you lose your home, your family, you lose everything, and everybody tells you as a nine-year-old kid they're doing all of this in the name of God, in the name of religion, you end up hating religion. You know, and so most nine-year-olds don't think stuff like, I hate God. They think stuff like, I don't know, should I eat this crayon or whatever? But I was nine when I decided I hated God, because I thought, if he hates me, you know, I'll hate him.
We want to pick up the story as you resettle in the U.S., but I'm just thinking that there are probably lots of nine-year-olds in your native land, you know, that are wondering today about, you know, where is God in the midst of all this? I mean, in all the unrest and the hate, these are dark days in many ways, aren't they?
They really are. It's interesting you just said that, because you're so right. I mean, Neil, there are nine-year-olds and 90-year-olds, I think, all over the world, especially in that 1040 window, that are seeing, honestly, the destructive power of religion. And it's such a reminder for us that religion does not work. You know, the most messed up places in the world, you know, are the most religious places in the world, sadly, today. And so you look at the places where there is no separation in church and state. Church is state, meaning religion has taken over places like Afghanistan and places like that. And you just really see the destructive power of radical religion. You know, and it doesn't really change the state of someone's heart. It just tries to modify behavior, and it just always ends up doing more damage than good. And so I think there are a lot of nine-year-olds in Iran today who just think, wow, religion isn't working. And so is their 19-year-old brother thinks the same thing, and so does, you know, so does their grandpa at 90. And it's such a testament that Christianity is not religion, but it's a relationship, and it's grace.
Was religion important to you and your family as a child? I mean, you were Muslim by culture, I guess, and birth. So was it something that you practiced religiously, I guess, quote-unquote?
That's a good way to put it. Do we practice religion religiously? I like that. Man, honestly, we were never that devout, Neil. Like the most devout that my parents ever were as Muslims was the night I became a Christian. Instantly, they said, "You can't be a Christian. We're Muslims." And I was like, "We are? You know, we never really were until I became a Christian." And it was really more my father's pride. And, you know, he lost his pedigree. He'd lost his place in the army. He'd lost his fortunes when he'd escaped from Iran. And now in his mind, because of his son converting to Christianity, they'd lost their religion as well. You know, their heritage more than anything. But yeah, we weren't super devout. We were Muslim by name. And we definitely, growing up, you know, I was taught the prayers and I was taught, you know, certain things. But the most devout I ever saw my parents was when I was 18 years old and to a testimony of just a really great missional church, I ended up becoming a Christian. And when I gave my life to Christ, my parents instantly knee-jerked and pushed back by saying, "No, you can't be a Christian. We're Muslims."
I want to have you tell more of that story in a moment, but go back a minute first maybe and talk about what it means to be an exile, a refugee, and what parts are the most difficult. You, as I understand, I think you had... Had you been in the States before? Your father had done some training in the States militarily, right?
He sure had. Yeah. My dad had taken flight training, like you were just alluding to, and he knew about America. They loved the United States because he'd come several different times just to get training to go back and be a helicopter pilot in Iran. But when the revolution happened, you know, so when the revolution happened, we knew that my dad instantly knew that if there was a place to go and begin again, there was no better place than the United States. I mean, it truly is, you know, the greatest nation in the world. It is a nation of second chances and new beginnings, you know. And so my mom and dad knew, like, no doubt about it, if we can get to America, that's where we want to, you know, start our lives. And so, yeah, the revolution happened and we escaped and we were stuck in Europe for about 9 months. And we tried legally, illegally, every way we could to make it to the States, and the doors just wouldn't open up for us until one day my mom got us together as a family, and she said, "Hey, we want to go to America. Let's pray to America's God." She showed us a picture of a white man with a mullet and a beard. She said, "This is Jesus. He's American." And so we didn't know any better. We just prayed to Jesus and asked him to let us into his country, and even though that's a pretty theologically incorrect prayer, God was bigger than our theology. You know, we prayed, and what I know now is that God was beginning his good work in us, because a week later, the doors opened up, and we were flying to America. When we came to America, you know, I was, a 10-year-old kid who came to America, you know, escaping religion, but in the back of my mind, I do remember thinking, I want to have nothing to do with religion, but thanks, Jesus, for letting us into your country. So that's my first memory of Jesus. And I think that's how God just used that little moment in my life to kind of put a wedge in this really hardened heart to say, you know what, don't think of Jesus as religion. And then we came to the States and kind of became that exile family. I mean, we came here in the middle of the hostage situation where 54 Americans were being held hostage in the American embassy in Iran, you know, in the midst of the revolution. And so we were from the wrong place at the wrong time. People were watching on TV how Iranians were burning the flag, the American flag, and calling America the great Satan and, you know, beating the hostages. And so we were on the receiving end of all kinds of just anger from people in America who were just seeing Iran treat their people very badly. And so here we'd moved in, you know. And so I was the outcasted kid. I was the kid who for years and years just was the exile. I came here, fish out of water, completely didn't blend in. Plus, I was from the wrong place. I was from Iran. And so I ate my lunch alone every day at the lunchroom table, never got invited to the parties. I know what it's like to go to the school as a new kid and not have any friends.
Talk a little bit about, you know, as a foreign-born, you know, student, I mean, you kind of were in that pretender role. I mean, I think that's pretty common, right? What advice would you give others that maybe are in, you know, that are saying, I'm just trying to fake it, to fit in, and, you know, clearly I don't. What would you recommend?
Sure, absolutely. So just to back up a little bit and give a little context to what you were referring to, you know, I was kind of the outcasted kid who didn't blend in. And then the day before my freshman year in high school, my dad felt sorry for me for being the outcasted kid and just took me to the mall and, for lack of better terms, gave me an extreme makeover. And so I went to school. I like to tell people I went from geek to chic, you know. And, man, I came to the American high school and found friends, honestly, because I just kind of conformed to the patterns of the world. I mean, I just became a kid who learned how to just show up at school, and people will receive you a lot of times because of what you wear and who you end up at the lunchroom table by. And I was the outcasted kid for years, and then I learned during high school to play the opposite. I learned how to kind of become what everybody wanted me to become, and I learned how to end up at the right lunchroom table, and I learned how to dump the right girl before she could dump me, and how to be cold to be perceived as cool. And I just played high school. And so many times people are just alone and insecure, and how that manifests itself is you end up putting on the dog and pony show just because you're just tired of being alone. And at least when I was a nobody, I was David Nasser, the nobody, but all I'd become is really just a kid who'd sold out. And it's so true, you know, where it says in scripture, what good is it for a man to gain the whole world but to forfeit his soul? Because that's what I've done. I just completely sold my identity just in order to have friends. Even when they're fabricated friends, you know, it still felt to me better than the loneliness that I was going through.
Coming up after break, we're going to talk about some friends that befriended David. And they saw through, I mean, who he was trying to be and didn't give up on him. And we'll talk more about his story. We're reflecting on the story he's written in the book, Jumping Through Fires, the gripping story of one man's escape from revolution to redemption. David Nasser, one of America's foremost evangelists now, speaks to hundreds of thousands of people each year. And we're going to get more of the story coming up in a moment. And we're going to talk about how his family found their way to Jesus. Some amazing stories yet to come. So stay tuned for more here on Connecting Faith, talking with David Nasser today. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Today we're hearing David Nasser's story. David's an evangelist, a speaker, an author of several books, including his memoir, Jumping Through Fires, the gripping story of one man's escape from revolution to redemption. Here's more. David, let's go back and pick up the story a little bit, because you're in high school and kind of out of high school. You ran into some guys who actually started caring about you and shared Jesus with you, and you weren't really interested because you were living kind of another life at the time. Pick up the story from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, I was just this kid, Neil, that was pretty broken. I mean, I think a lot of times something is broken, and you try to fix it, and it ends up being even worse. And so here I was, this pretty insecure kid, going through all kinds of issues, you know, being the loner out of a revolution. And then the way that we try to fix that as a family was my dad just bought me a lot of clothes and got me a really cool car, and I just went the popular route with school. And a lot of people think that the way you solve loneliness is popularity, but honestly, there's just more brokenness. You know, it's kind of, I call it, you know, putting a cup of gasoline on a fire to try to put it out. You know, it just does the opposite. And so I graduated from high school popular, but I graduated from high school suicidal and even more alone and even more broken. And so I kind of went into depression after high school. And one day, a few months after high school, was out, I was in the car, to be really frank and honest, with a buddy of mine. And he and I were smoking some marijuana together. We just kind of passing a joint back and forth. And as we were passing the joint back and forth, I told him, I said, man, we've graduated from high school. All our buddies are gone. You know, what are we going to do next? Where are we going to go be social next? And my buddy invited me to church. It was crazy because he was literally, you know, handing me a joint while he's inviting me to church. But that is so Southern culture, you know? And so my buddy said, hey, I've got an idea. You ought to come to church with me tomorrow. And I was surprised. I mean, he's handing me Mexican Red Bud while he's inviting me to church. And I know it says in the Bible in Genesis that God made the grass and it was good, but that's not what it means, right? And so, man, I said, really, you go to church? And he said, I don't ever miss church. I love church. And I told him, I said, I'm not going to church. And he said, why? And I said, because I've seen religion destroy my country. I want to have nothing to do with religion. And he said, oh, man, you've got it wrong. He goes, this is Christianity, you know? And he told me all the reasons I needed to come to his Christian church, because this youth group, he told me, was so social and so fun. And I wasn't interested until he named the five prettiest girls from my high school. And when he got to the five and he said, hey, they all go to my church, I felt motivated to visit. Sure. So I am literally the product of what it's like for God to use these different things that aren't even the main thing, you know, to bring someone to church. And so I'm a big advocate of doing a lot of little bitty things to be attractional as a church, because at the end of the day, no one ever comes to Christ because someone's got a really nice youth building. But man, if that's what it takes for someone to come into the context to hear the gospel, then man, that's fine. You know, I'm a product of, I went to the church for the wrong reason, but God was bigger than my reason. And when I got there to that church, even though I went for the wrong reason, what I ran into were a lot of authentic Christians. I didn't run into a youth group. I like to call it a youth ministry instead. And there were these students from this church. And when they saw me coming, they were just like, wow, there's the kid who always parties at school. And there's the kid who always is drunk on a Saturday night. And so they saw me coming, and they just decided I was foreign missions come to town. Like, they didn't even need a passport to reach the 1040 window. I was showing up at their door. And so, man, they just started loving on me and my family, and they started visiting me and coming to my house and sharing the gospel with me. And for the next 8 weeks, these Christians from this youth ministry would come to my house on Monday night and talk to me about Jesus. And then they would come to my house on Sundays and on Wednesdays, and they would drag me to church. They would just put me in the car and drag me to church. And I say drag me to church, I acted like I didn't want to go. But honestly, I really wanted to go, because there was something very distinct, very different about these people, I remember thinking, that I'd never seen before. And what it was grace. They were gracious. They were graceful. And they had something that wasn't religious. You know, they had something that was actually contagious. It was actually very different. And so I went and to the church and heard the gospel for 8 weeks. And yeah, that was the beginning of it for me.
Was there a tipping point? You're talking about, you know, experiencing grace, and after determining that you want nothing to do with religion, suddenly you're exposed to, you know, these guys and gals with, you know, not everybody's perfect, but they understood that. So talk about maybe that turning point for you, and then how that spread to your family.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a turning point. That's a good way to put it. I wish you'd given me that before I wrote my book. I had a chapter called Turning Point. The turning point for me was not a sermon, even though I just want to go on record and say, man, that guy could preach, you know, the one that I heard for 8 weeks. The turning point wasn't the organ that they had of the church, even though they had an amazing organ, like instilled in marble walls, beautiful sanctuary. The turning point wasn't the music cantata, even though they had an incredible music department. What I remember was that we would go to eat after church and they would just buy my meal. I remember the generosity of the people. And one night we were eating after church at this restaurant, and we got done eating, like a Shoney's or something. It wasn't anything fancy, but we were all piled in this car. They were about to give me a ride home. And we got in the car, and as we were backing out of the parking space, the waitress that had waited on us earlier that night, you know, just a few minutes before the restaurant, that was in the back seat. And I remember she ran to the car and started banging on the window right by where I was sitting. And, you know, they stopped the car. Everybody was kind of startled that the waitress had ran out to the parking lot to stop us. And they rolled the window down, and she yelled in the car. She said, "Hey, you guys need to get out of the car and check your pockets." She said, "Apparently somebody has way overpaid." She said, "Look, the bill was like $30 for everybody, and you guys paid like $130 or whatever." And she said, "Hey, obviously somebody accidentally put down the wrong amount of money." And the guy that was driving the car, Neil, turned around and looked at her and said, "Ma'am, that wasn't a mistake." And she said, "What do you mean?" And I remember sitting in this car in the parking lot of a Shoney's, and this guy looked at the waitress and said, "Hey, we realize it's Christmas time. We realize that you've worked really hard. You mentioned that you're working a double shift today because you're trying to get some Christmas money, you know, for gifts for your kids. And we just all on purpose emptied our pockets because we wanted to bless you." And this you know, waitress at this restaurant, she just starts crying in the parking lot because they just blessed her with such, you know, just love and grace and generosity. And so she starts crying. And then the guy driving the car, the guy, his name was Larry, he looks at her and he says, "Hey, Mom, we're sorry." He goes, "You know, we'll come back next week." And she just yells out loud. Like, that was her natural reaction. As soon as he said, "We'll come back next week," she goes, "Well, make sure you get my table," you know, and and she starts crying. And I remember, like, the next thing you know, I started crying, and everybody in the car was crying. And as we were driving in the car, and we had left this lady in the parking lot just with money in her hand weeping, I remember just thinking, what is wrong with these people? And that was the turning point for me. You know, we had talked a lot of theology. I heard a lot of sermons. I had heard beautiful hymns. I had been impressed with a church that was built for the glory of God with a million-dollar organ. But you know what I remember? I remember the way that these people lived out the gospel in front of that waitress. And, you know, they told me about grace, but I never understood grace, you know, undeserving love, until they treat – and that waitress, I remember she was a horrible waitress. So the last thing she did was a great tip, but they treated her to the opposite of what she deserved. And that's the night I understood the grace of God. And so the turning point for me was honestly watching believers be believable, watching Christians be Christ-like. And so, man, that was the 1-2 punch. I mean, within 2 weeks, I was leaning in on every conversation, and, you know, I became a Christian.
David Nasser, since that time, has gone on to speak to thousands, had opportunities to share at the Billy Graham evangelistic events, and has written several books, including A Call to Die, A Call to Grace, Glory Revealed, traveled with some contemporary Christian artists, of which you would all know well, and we'll talk a little about that and more in just a moment as we hear more from David Nasser, talking about his book, the story that we've been referencing, told well in this wonderful book called Jumping Through Fires. It's the gripping story of one man's escape from revolution to redemption. More with David coming up in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. Stay tuned. We've been hearing David Nasser's story, how he encountered it and embraced it, and went from revolution to redemption. Talking to David Nasser about his memoir, the book called Jumping Through Fires. David's founder, David Nasser Outreach, and he has written several books, including Called to Die, Called to Grace, and Glory Revealed. And David, I know that you had opportunity to be mentored by some really wonderful, gifted Christian evangelists and teachers and leaders. Talk a little bit about maybe that mentoring and how maybe the church can do a better job of discipling young adults today.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is my heart. As a matter of fact, that is why I just took this position at Liberty University, so that I could hopefully be able to begin to pay back a little bit of what God did in my life and putting mentors into my life. I'm now, you know, in my mid-40s, but when I was 18 years old, a brand new believer, I'm so grateful that men like Dr. Jay Strack stepped into my life and just took me under their wing and said, hey, you know what? Here's a young buck with a ton of fuzz on his antlers who has a lot of passion but not a lot of content, has a lot of energy, has a lot of giftings maybe, but not a lot of maturity. And we just want to help raise him up by getting him deep-rooted in Scripture, by giving him experiences, and by making sure that he doesn't get a big head but continues to stay humble, you know, as God elevates his opportunities, you know, to preach. And so I think the church honestly gets a bad rap for not doing that well. I think the church is really doing that in a good well. But I actually do think, well, we could get better. I don't think it's broken. But I think where the church could get even better, we could all improve, is to really be on the prowl for those who God has uniquely made and called into ministry, and to ask the first question right. Like, the first question is, okay, so you love drama and God just saves you and you want to further the kingdom of God, reveal the kingdom of God to people through drama. How do we help you do that? How do we equip you as a saint to do the work of ministry? Or, hey, you're a basketball player and you want to leverage your incredible ability to take a basketball and do amazing things. How do we help you further, you know, God's cause to bring out the renown of Jesus, you know, through your gifting? Or, hey, you're a preacher, you're a persuader. Hey, you're administrative, you know? And so I think the church would do well to ask that question of a 17-year-old, a 15-year-old, who senses that they want to leverage their life for the glory of God. They want to do ministry and mission with their life and their gifting. And then we can come along and say, how do we help you? And sometimes the way that we begin to really help someone like that is that we connect them with someone who's further up the mountain in that same field. And we put them in a mentorship. You know, it doesn't have to be so official. It can even be more unofficial. For me, it was never called mentorship. I was just an intern. But by the way, intern was a fancy way of saying, like, I was Jay Strack's intern. But Neil, basically, I was his T-shirt salesman. I mean, I traveled around and set up boxes of T-shirts and his books, and I sat in the lobby at his events. And the beauty of that was, while I was doing that, he also gave me an opportunity to be around him, to be a fly on the wall in dinners that we would go and eat. And Dr. Strack and an incredible pastor would have a conversation, and I just didn't miss the opportunity to shut up and listen. You know, but I got a window into the life of some incredible people. And I watched Jay Strack not only travel as a communicator, but I also watched him be a dad and a husband and navigate through those waters of what's it like to miss a bunch of ball games, but yet have to make up for it as a father by making some other decisions, you know? And so I think we would do well as a church to find people that can give access to the next generation and just raise them up. By bringing almost like an apprenticeship more than anything else.
You have had access to a number of Christian recording artists. And in fact, that's maybe where we kind of first, or maybe I first became aware. You did some traveling for a while, I think, with Third Day, right? Tell us a little bit about those relationships and how that developed.
Yeah, man, that's kind of crazy. I was just humbled by even the idea that the Lord would allow me to have an opportunity to pour into these guys, you know, these and women that are in some of these bands that today have just become the modern day psalmists for our generation. But the short of it is, a lot of us kind of cut our teeth in ministry together. And so when I was out doing eighth grade boys Disciple Now group with, you know, five guys in a house somewhere, you know, Chris Tomlin was leading worship for those five guys, and we were just all getting going in ministry. When I met Third Day, they were a bunch of broke guys living out of a van, you know, with a whole lot of vision and not a whole lot more, you know, and we all just kind of got going together. And so it's funny. I mean, yesterday I was talking to Mac, and he's coming to Liberty to lead worship for 14,000 students at the largest convocation in the world, and we were laughing. We're like, how do we all end up here? How do I get a fancy title? How did you become the six-time Grammy-winning, you know, guy who sold millions of albums? And really the answer to that is nothing that we've done to deserve. It's just, I think, just faithfulness, you know, instead of, you know, God just calls us to be faithful, not famous. And I love men like Chris Tomlin and men like Matt Powell who just have just been faithful to just do what they do, and God has just decided to shine a spotlight on them, since their entire life is nothing more than to be a big spotlight shined on God, you know? And so, yeah, these artists, we end up at events together, you know, whether even early on in life or later on in life. I'm typically not the guy who shows up at an event with other speakers because I'm the speaker at the event. So I'm in the green room a lot with these artists. And when you show up a lot and you do a lot of meals together and a lot of events together, you end up pastoring these men, because a lot of them, I understand what it's like for them to be a dad. I understand what it's like for them to live in a fishbowl. Many of them in a much greater sense than myself. And so the Lord just allowed me to be able to walk into their lives and be a pastor to some of these people. And they have a safe place with me where they can come and confide, and I can walk through it with them. A lot of times, a lot of these men and these women in these Christian bands, their pastor doesn't understand their lifestyle. Their pastor doesn't understand the calling for them to be a road warrior. And I think the Lord's just granted me some of that opportunity. And so that's kind of how some of that got going. And then eventually you start doing projects with some of these guys. And so, like, for example, the Third Day guys, and actually Mac in particular and I, did a project called Glory Revealed, where we did verbatim scripture music, where Mac wrote the songs out of God's word. I wrote a book called Glory Revealed. We had a CD called Glory Revealed. And so we got to kind of co-labor in a more official sense as well. And yeah, and just a handful of tours and stuff like that. But, man, at the end of the day, I'm just the Iranian redneck, man, who just loves God and loves these bands. And it's funny, I'm a big fan myself, you know, of these people as well. So I'm not just the guy pastoring them. I genuinely love Christian music and what it does for me in life.
In your and we don't have time to get to the story about you, you know, meeting and marrying your lovely wife, Jennifer, but you sort of challenged her about not settling. And I'm wondering if maybe that you have a challenge for us listening today about not settling in their faith journey.
Man, I do a lot of interviews. Nobody ever gets that chapter out. That's great. Yeah, in the book, Jumping Through Fires, I talk about meeting my wife. And like you were saying, I mean, my wife, by the way, is the – it's funny. She was 18 when she became a Christian. I was 18 when I became a Christian. She got delivered out of religion. I got delivered out of religion. She was like Bible drill champion for a good Southern Baptist church. She was 16 when she was on the pastor search committee of her church. You know, like everybody else was 50. She was, I tell people kiddingly, you know, the worst thing my wife did was read under a dim light, get that tag off the pillow you're not supposed to. My wife was good. I mean, she was about Amish, honestly. She was so good in her behavior. But my wife was 18 as the lead counselor. She was leading the counseling at a Christian event, at an evangelistic event, when she walked down the aisle, took off her counselor badge, and told her youth pastor, I don't know the Lord. And so my wife was 18 and got delivered out of religion, and I was 18 and I got delivered out of religion. The funny thing is she got delivered out of a lot of self-righteousness. I got delivered out of a lot of unrighteousness. But God somehow kind of put us together. And we met at a camp. And when we met at a camp, she had a boyfriend. She's the only guy she'd ever dated. She'd been dating him for 4 years. And they're about to get hooked up and get married. And when I met her at a camp, you know, we just started to have a conversation. And I wasn't honing in on another brother's, you know, girlfriend. I wanted to know this godly woman that was at the camp. She was a counselor and I was a counselor. And I asked her what her dreams and ambitions were for life. And she had pretty audacious things that she wanted to see God do. Funny thing enough, is Keith Green's music had really pushed the envelope, you know, in her life, and had kind of reconfigured a lot of the safety nets in her life out. And so she wanted to do great things with her life for the glory of God. But yet, the funny thing of that was she was marrying a guy who just wanted to get in traffic, go sit in a cubicle, have an everyday 9-to-5 job, and just live it safe and be a Sunday school teacher. And nothing wrong with that at all. But she had pretty audacious dreams, and she said, I feel like I'm going to marry this guy who's a good guy, but he doesn't really want to color outside the lines. And so I tell him the story. I said, I looked at her and said, look, you can do a whole lot better than me, but at least with me, we're going to double down on a lot of risk. And, that's what it took to get the girl. And so, yeah, my wife and I are living the risky dream right here at Liberty University.
Well, what a fun hour. Glad to connect with you and want to hear more of the story someplace down the road, perhaps, here. And we'll find out. Actually, we never got talking about what jumping through fires actually means. But, David, blessings to you. And thank you for your passion and your willingness to share the story. It's great to visit with you today.
Man, thanks for having me on. Thanks for all you do on the airwaves, just bringing hope and grace. And blessings to your amazing show, brother.
David Nasser just telling us a bit of his story. He's written several books, including A Call to Die, A Call to Grace, Glory Revealed, and Jumping Through Fires, the gripping story of one man's escape from revolution to redemption. It's a memoir of his family's escape from Iran and experience in America. And David is an evangelist and a speaker, and he is a senior vice president at Liberty University. And he's founder of the David Nasser Outreach. And through broadcast television and events, he reaches more than 700,000 people annually with the gospel. Well, thank you for listening to this great conversation. Now, there's more to come here in Connecting Faith as we take some time to talk about sleep. Lisa Marone joins us. Her regular every other Monday visit is coming up in just a moment. Back to Connecting Faith, and on every other Monday, we have the opportunity to connect with Lisa Marone, physical therapist, professor, author, and speaker, and she's always encouraging us to get healthy, for heaven's sake, title of one of her great books, 7 Steps to Living Strong, Loving God, and Serving Others. She's written a number of books, and we always enjoy the opportunity to talk health, fitness, and just well-being, and hopefully you had a great weekend and slept well, but Lisa, today we want to talk about the fact that weekend sleep should be pretty much the same as the week. Is that right?
That's very, a lot of people, not just those who are employed, but, a lot of our high school kids are doing this same sleep method, which is really working against our biological clocks. We will get up very early Monday through Friday. We are usually staying up very late on the nights before those early wakings. And we're just really squeezing out a lot of our sleep time. And then we just figure, well, I'll just sleep in, So instead of getting up at 6:30, I'm getting up at 10:30 in the morning on Saturday or Sunday. And that's just not working for our biological clocks. We're really messing them up.
You talk about something called the sleep architecture and that they're actually, our bodies really need some sort of rhythm. Say more about that.
Beautiful thing that God has created in us is this circadian rhythm, and it's this rhythm of sleep and wake cycles. And particularly in sleep cycles, I love that God is such a cool architect because everything has form and function that God has created. And so even our sleep has form and function. So when we sleep during the night meal, we go through five, if we give ourselves 7 to 8 hours of sleep, we'll go through about 5 sleep cycles. And each sleep cycle is about a 90-minute duration. And through those 90 minutes, we're going to go from a period of fragmented sleep. That's kind of where you're floating between awake and asleep. That's kind of when one of your limbs might just jerk out from you, your arm or leg. That's that fragmented sleep cycle. That's about 5 minutes. And then God brings us down into this light sleep time, which is approximately an hour. And when we're in that light sleep cycle, there's certain things that are happening and manufacturing within our bodies. And then we head into deep sleep for about 3 to 18 minutes or so. And finally, we end up in that dream phase of sleep. And that dream phase of sleep is architected for really particular things. And so we need, Neil, each one of those phases of sleep. And we need to go through 5 cycles each night if we're really going to function the way that God has created us to function.
Just recently in looking through my Sunday paper, the Parade magazine had the whole focus on sleep, and they said, you're doing it wrong, and I'm sure you can affirm it as well, that we don't really get enough sleep in this nation anymore, do we?
Yeah, you know, not only are we doing it wrong, we're just not doing it enough, you know. So there's about 74% of us on average that are not getting enough sleep at night, and so that's a real problem because studies have shown that sleep is the most important predictor for how long we will live, not what our body weight is, but how much we sleep. And so when we think we can burn the candle at both ends without messing up our lifespans, we're really wrong about that. And so there's disease processes such as insulin resistance and accelerated aging that are occurring when we're cheating ourselves out of sleep. And so the wrong part of doing it wrong, I really encourage people to look at their weekends not as like this free-for-all where they're just going to sleep all day, but really to craft your weekends to look almost like your week. Now, you can give yourself an extra hour of sleep on the weekend mornings, but any more than that, and you're really going to mess with that circadian rhythm. And so we need to be really diligent, Neil, on the going-to-bed side of things, where if we know we need to be up at 6 o'clock in the morning, then we need to count back 7 hours at least and be lights out in bed at 11 the night before.
That's really the only way to, the best way to get more sleep, right, is to do it on the front end.
Yeah, you know, in the, I love the creation story in Genesis where God says that he always describes it was night and it was day the first day. It was night and it was day the second day. And so our days really begin the night before. And so we really need to make sure that we are going to sleep. And some of my patients will tell me, well, I just can't get to sleep early. I have so much to do. And then I said, well, then that's a deeper core problem where you need to figure out why you're doing too much, because God has given us all the ability and the same 24 hours. And so we need to care for our bodies. And that's going to be a really critical thing for us to be aware of. That maybe we're just doing too much and cheating ourselves out of sleep.
And if we are, you know, thinking we can catch up on the weekends, we end up in the kind of, I think you describe it as the jet lag mode, right? I mean, that we're not benefiting by adding more sleep. Even, I mean, would a short nap be better?
You know, naps are interesting. If you happen to be sick or you had a particular night of bad sleep, it is fine to get a nap the next day to make up for it. And a nap, really, only 15 minutes to 20 minutes is refreshing. A nap of like 60 minutes makes your head feel like it's full of cement. So that's not a good time to wake up. That wakes you up somewhere in your deep sleep cycle. We're not supposed to get up then. If you have a problem with sleeping every night and you find you have to nap every day, what you're actually doing is kind of feeding that problem. And so because what happens when we nap is we have these tired molecules, if you would, collect in our brain all day long. They're called adenosine molecules. And based upon how many adenosine molecules are attached to our brain means that we're more and more sleepy, the more molecules that attach. And so when we take a nap, we kind of wipe those down. And so if you're napping every day and then having trouble sleeping through the night, it's because you've wiped out too many adenosine molecules. We don't have enough tired signals going to our brain.
Well, I guess, I mean, we're talking about messing with your biological clock, getting enough sleep, that we need to count backwards. And, you know, it probably should go without saying, but there are a few things that we could do to actually get ourselves ready for sleep a little more easily, right? And most of us are kind of wired to our screens right till the last minute. That's not a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the last hour of awake time really should be orchestrated in a way that is ramping us down towards sleep. We shouldn't be answering that one last email, dropping our laptop off the side of our bed and turning our lights off. That doesn't do us very good. And so it's really important, first of all, that our environment starts to darken that last hour or so. We need to make melatonin, which is a hormone that helps our brain not only to fall asleep, but to maintain our sleep throughout the night. And that is going to be dependent upon how dark our environment is. The darker it is, the more melatonin that's produced. That's why on dark, rainy days, we're all yawning, you know. So that's really important. Dim the lights in your house. maybe shut your television down and do something quieter like reading. Don't have a discussion with your spouse in bed about like the credit card bill that has to be paid. That's not the last thing you want to be talking about, or you know, how to handle your frustrating teenager. It's really a time to just quiet yourself emotionally, quiet yourself environmentally, and please sleep in a room that's clear of clutter because your mind needs to see peace. Your eyes need to see peaceful surroundings before you head off to sleep.
You know, you mentioned teenagers. You know, oftentimes, you know, they're we think they're the most notorious for not getting enough sleep, but it's really at every age the sleep cycle is needed, right? So whether we're 19 or we're 89, we still all need about the same amount of sleep, don't we?
Yeah, well, you know, our younger teenagers, they actually need a little more sleep than we do. They need more like 9 hours of sleep. And unfortunately, the way our school systems work for them, we make them start like super early in the morning, 7 a.m. or sometimes even earlier. They're at the bus stop. And so it is difficult for them to get the right amount of sleep. For your teenagers, you absolutely have to have like a cell phone check-in thing for them so that at, you know, 9, 10 o'clock, everybody's leaving their cell phone in the drawer in the kitchen. They're not hearing it bling all night long. It's not their alarm clock. Get them an alarm clock. It'll cost you $10. Get that cell phone out of their room so that they can calm down and quiet down before they go to sleep so that they can sleep well.
You know, I'm amazed, as you said right at the outset, that this is as important a predictor of longevity as anything else. That just seems so startling, and who would have expected that?
None of us would have expected that because we always feel like if we can push through the day, then we've mastered it. You know, more coffee. Coffee, by the way, blocks those adenosine molecules to the brain. That's why we stay awake with coffee. Also gives us lots of adrenaline, which wears down our body. But, you know, we think that we've beat it, but we have not. You know, many, many years ago, I worked for a man who was just this amazing Christian man, very vibrant, but he was full throttle. He slept about 4 hours a night. He was very proud of that fact. And at 44, he came down with lymphoma, a cancer, and we thought, oh, he's going to beat that. He's so strong and vibrant, but in 3 months, it had taken his life. Because lack of sleep over time is going to just really hamper your immune system for fighting off anything. So we all make cancer cells. I'm making them right now. Neil, you're making them. But our bodies have the ability through our immune system to kill them off before they come to anything. But if you don't sleep well, day in and day out, night in and night out, you just can't fight off what our bodies produce or what environmentally produces in us.
Well, we know that the Lord gives sleep, and so if that's an issue that you're having maybe a hard time getting to sleep or staying asleep, and it's an opportunity maybe to just reflect on a verse or two and to make it a commitment to say, let's set the clock back. We'll do our own daylight savings time or sleep savings time here and be a little more committed to it. So, Lisa, thank you for your good words and advice today.
You're welcome. You're welcome. It is a gift from God. Let's accept it from Him.
Talking sleep today with Lisa Marone. You can find out more about her writing and her work at her website, lisamarone.com. That's M-O-R-R-O-N-E, lisamarone.com. Physical therapist, professor, author, and speaker, encouraging us to get healthy for heaven's sake. Well, I hope that you enjoyed our conversation with Lisa and benefited from that. Hey, I want to encourage you to be listening tomorrow here on Connecting Faith. Chuck Bentley will come back to join us. We'll talk finances, wise investments, being a good steward, all those important things. So, Dana, we'll sleep well tonight,
yes.
And then we'll worry about money tomorrow.
That sounds good, yeah.
No.
And we can always remember to choose joy in the journey as well.
I know. We're excited about this special offer that we have. Kay Warren's little devotional book called Choose Joy. We're giving one away a day here right through Easter. And so you can sign up online today and sign up for your copy. Great way to just be encouraged.
Yes, just go to myfaithradio.com. You'll see it right there on our main page. You can register to win. Myfaithradio.com.
Thanks for listening to Connecting Faith. If you missed part of today's show, of course, you can always catch it online. We post the interviews on the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.